Today on the Rising Coaches Podcast.
It's like winning the lottery to become a Division I head coach. It's so hard. I understand this job is like people say it's impossible. You know, I talked to Shaka, who's one of my mentors, and he told me, you know, you don't need to do that. You can get a better, all this stuff. And I walked out of the gym. I called my wife and I said, we're going to do it. And she almost cried. and I called her and I said, I'm coming.
Today's podcast is brought to you by the Rising Coaches Association, the biggest coaching tree in all of basketball. Sign up for the Rising Coaches Association now for just $120 a year and become part of our community, relationships, and development. We talk about it all the time. There's no straight lines in this profession. There's only ups and downs. You need a community that knows exactly what you're going through and has been there before to help lean on during the rough times of the industry. You need genuine relationships, not just exchanging numbers, not just meeting new people at the Final Four in the off season. You should be doing it all year round, and we provide tremendous opportunities to create those genuine relationships all through the year. And finally, development. We have so much content and so many resources so that you can work on your craft and become a better coach. Because we put such a premium and an emphasis on helping you establish new, genuine relationships, it takes all of the political BS side of the business out of the equation for you. All of that gets removed off of your plate. You can just worry about being you, making new friends in the business, and working on your craft and becoming the best coach that you can be and impacting the people that you're around on a daily basis. For more information, visit risingcoaches.com/membership on risingcoaches.com. All right, welcome back to another edition of the Rising Coaches Podcast. Today, we're joined by South Alabama head coach Richie Riley, coming off straight from a six-game win streak. Coach, what's up?
Hey, it's great to be on. I appreciate you having me.
Thanks for being here.
It's good to not be playing today, man. We played five games in 9 days, so I'm just glad we're not getting ready to tip it up here at lunchtime.
Well, I'm glad you're here with us today on your semi-off day. I guess you guys still practice this afternoon, but at least you're not going over scouting reports and getting ready to tip it up tonight. So,
no, for sure. Thanks. We'll be a little lighter today. We've been playing with basically six or seven guys all season long, so I better not press them too much coming off five games in 9 days. So we'll be a little bit lighter as we get ready to play this weekend.
Well, this is really good podcast scheduling on my part, right? Because if I would have caught you 2-3 weeks ago when you guys were sitting at 2-5 and trying to get it going, I probably would have gotten a different Richie Riley, but six in a row and in first place, you got to be feeling pretty good, right?
Yeah, there's no question. I would have been in a little bit different mindset a couple of weeks ago, but our guys have really played well and proud of them. We've been able to, as we took over first place on Saturday when we won at Troy, and getting better. We're not nearly to the finish line yet. We got a ways to go. We got to keep getting better, continue improving. But we are making strides. And, you know, I joke around, we're at least following the right map now. Early in the year, we were looking at the wrong map. So there's no way we could get to the final destination. We're finally at least understanding what goes into winning and playing pretty well right now.
What was like the biggest factor that got it turned around? Did a switch flip for your guys, or did something in team meeting behind closed doors?
A little bit. It's been an odd year with COVID. It's been an odd year. And for us, we've been able to, you know, thankfully stay safe, and we've not had any issues as far as pauses, but it has been issues mentally. And we had some new guys. And it took us a minute to kind of come together and understand what goes into winning. I think that's the biggest thing. I take a lot of pride. Our teams usually play their best basketball late in the season. Last year, we finished on an 8-game win streak and then got shut down because of COVID. We were in the semifinals of the Sun Belt tournament. And then this year, we've won six in a row. And closing in, we got four more regular season games left. And then obviously the tournament. So we usually play better late. I think it's a product of – I got a really good staff, and we put a lot of time into it, so we usually improve as the year goes on and hopefully continue to hit our stride and play well these last four.
Burn the boats, right?
Yeah, burn the boats. Yeah, that's how we live down here. It's how I've always been. That's a lot of places you have, you know, the motto of your team. It's kind of, you know, just stuff on a shirt or on the wall. This Burn the Boats is really near and dear to me. It's who we are, and it's who I've always been.
I love it. All right, Coach, let's kind of talk about your coaching journey a little bit. If you can jog your memory and go back to the days where you were trying to break in. Your first jobs were Georgetown College, which great job, by the way, Hawaii Pacific and Pikeville. So you really got you cut your teeth at the small college level, NAIA. What did that do for like your mentality, and what did that do for like your growth as a coach?
The biggest thing it did for me is it helped me learn the craft of coaching. It helped me to know what I was doing. And that's something I preach to young guys all the time is, you know, when you get your opportunity, you have to be prepared to make the most of it. And without those experiences, when I got to Coastal Carolina, I would not have known what I was doing. And it would have taken me a long time to figure it out. But I started out, I was a volunteer at Georgetown College while I was still in school at Eastern Kentucky. And I would drive 40 minutes one way every day for practice. And I was a glorified manager. You know, I swept the floors, drove the coaches wherever they wanted to go, picked up their lunch. And at the NAI level, as far as recruiting goes, like volunteers like me could go recruiting, you know, so they didn't send me out after any players, but they would let me drive them. So I would get to sit in the gym and, you know, watch games and get to meet people and do all those things. So I was always willing to drive when they would let me. And I would go with those guys, the assistants or Coach Osborne. And I was there for a while. Then I went to Hawaii Pacific. And the way that deal went was Kurt Young, who's on my staff now, he's director of scouting for me now, was best friends with Kelly Wells. And Kelly had just become the head coach at Hawaii Pacific. And they had a spot that was only paying $8,000 a year. And so, no, there wasn't a lot. There wasn't a long line for the job. So I told those guys, you know, I'd love to have it. And I got a credit card, went out there, maxed it out to $5,000 or $6,000 just to survive, just to pay for my apartment, food and things like that. And it was a long 8 months. But I got to learn, and I got to deal with adversity of trying to be out on my own for the first time, because I'd never been more than 40 minutes from home. I grew up in London, Kentucky, and went to school at Eastern Kentucky, which was 40 minutes up the road. So I was away from home for the first time, 6 hours time difference, and actually coaching and doing scouting reports and recruiting, and had a lot of responsibility. But after the season, Kelly got the job at Pikeville, and he brought me back as his top assistant. And I was there for 3 years. And you know, it was really good for me because we didn't have anybody else. So I did every scout, recruited the majority of the guys, and got to learn from a great coach. Kelly Wells is one of the best to ever do it. He'll be an NAI Hall of Famer. And I got to do that with a lot of responsibility. But I also had humbling tasks that I had to do too. I would coach the guys really hard on the court, and then I would go wash their jerseys right in front of them. You know, I was doing the laundry. I was driving the bus to away games or the vans to away games, and basically doing anything and everything. So it was great for me. And it, all the small school experiences kind of shaped who I am, developed a chip on my shoulder, and also an appreciation for all the things that I'm blessed to do now.
Yeah. One thing, cause we always tell our guys, you know, just get a great job working for a great boss, that seems to be a common thread in your career. You've worked for some great head coaches, Happy Osborne, you mentioned Kelly Wells, I think Cliff Ellis, Brad Brownell, Coach Haas. I'm probably leaving somebody out, but those are some pretty good ones. That's pretty good company. But people, one of the fears that people say is like, man, if I go to the small college level, I'll never be able to make that jump to Division One, which that's important to some people, and that's okay. How did you like continue to meet people and network, not just within NAI or Division Two or whatever? How did you make sure you were meeting people from all different levels?
Yeah, I worked really hard at it, that part of it, because I knew it was important. And anytime I tried to go to as many events as I could, even if I was paying the money out of my own pocket, because we didn't have obviously a big budget at Pikeville, but I would get out and go go to tournaments, AAU events, all this stuff. And even if I had to pay it out of my own pocket, just so that I could continue to meet people and also continue to get better at evaluating. I think as you climb in the ranks, it's good to know what, you know, what levels are. And I think that helped me too, to see, you know, I'd go watch an AAU tournament. This kid be going to, you know, wherever, some mid-major school. And I could see what talent level this to evaluate better. But my big break came in Coastal Carolina. I'd just taken the job at Arkansas Fort Smith. I was excited about it. They just went D2. And I'd been there 2 weeks with Josh Newman. Great guy, great ball coach too. But I'd been there 2 weeks. And a really good friend of mine, Brian Coleman, who's at Winthrop, he developed a really good relationship with Cliff Ellis. And coach had asked him about, you know, somebody that could really help in recruiting with transfers, junior college, recruiting in the South. And he told him about me. So coach called me, and I was shocked. I'd grown up watching Cliff Ellis coach at Auburn on old Jefferson Pilot when I was a kid in London, Kentucky. And he's a national coach of the year and a future Hall of Famer, in my opinion. And he called, and he offered me an opportunity to interview. And I told him, you know, yeah, I'm pumped to interview. So I went to Coach Newman, which was kind of awkward. I'd been there 2 weeks, and asked him, you know, I told him I was excited about it and told him the whole situation. He said, if you go interview, you better get the job, which meant I didn't have a chance to do that. So I called a bunch of people. I called Brian Coleman too. And I said, hey man, you think I really have a chance to get it? I don't need to just go interview and then go unemployed. And he told me, you know, I think you got a good chance if it goes well. And so I told coach the whole situation. Coach Ellis told me not to go, told me not to come down there and interview. And I thought about it for about probably 24 hours. And I went in, I turned my letter of resignation in to Coach Newman, and got in a car, drove 15 hours and interviewed. It was a 2-day deal, and ended up getting it about 4 or 5 days later. So it was a big relief. And that was, you know, it's one of my burn the boat stories. I burned the boat. I didn't have any option except to succeed. And if I didn't, then I was going to be jobless and basically starting completely over. So luckily I got the job. Coach believed in me, and we had a great 2 years there. And then things have been going pretty fast ever since.
Yeah, they have. Okay. You mentioned something while you were telling that story, talking about transfers. You were really kind of ahead of the curve. Of course, now every program in the country has got multiple transfers on their team, but you were really ahead of the curve on that, and started really recruiting transfers heavily. You know, I don't know how early you started doing that. Maybe Coastal Carolina was what, 2012 for you?
It was, yeah, 2010, 11, maybe, okay. Something like that. But yeah, I've always tried to be ahead of the curve in recruiting. I feel like we went through a wave there in when I was at Coastal, Eastern Kentucky, and UAB, where there was really a market to get into junior college recruiting. Those guys were really impacting the game. And we had, when I was at UAB, we had, I think, 4 all-conference USA guys that were JUCO guys at Eastern Kentucky. They went on that run with Corey Walden and Cozy and those guys, and won it in three straight 21 seasons. And then at Coastal, we had some really good JUCO guys. And I kind of built a brand with that at the time. And then I could kind of feel it was shifting. The transfer market had become way more prevalent. And I'd been doing that at Pikeville. When I was at Pikeville, we signed something like 18 transfers in my 3 years there.
Sure.
And back then, the difference, Adam, back then, is at the NAI level, you could get a transfer that was like a mid-major guy that averaged like 12 a game or something. And that doesn't happen now. You know, a mid-major guy that averaged 12 a game, you may go to the Power 5. So the market has shifted, but I've always tried to be a forward thinker and stay ahead of the curve when it comes to recruiting. And transfers have been really good for us. It's not the only thing we recruit. We've had the best class in our league, and that doesn't include transfers. They don't put that in the 247 rankings since we've been here. Signed a lot of 3-star guys, borderline 4-star high school kids. And we signed a junior college kid this year and last year. So we're still very involved in JUCO hoops. But transfers are what we're known for. We've signed a lot of really good ones. We've got the leading transfer scorer in the country right now, Michael Flowers, transfer from Western Michigan, averaging 21 a game. So we try to develop a brand, a niche. I think for young coaches, it's important that you have a niche. You don't need to be one-dimensional, but you need to have a niche that people can grab a hold of when you're trying to get hired for these jobs. And they know what they're getting. That's what I tried to be as an assistant. Like, I try to have a niche. If I can come in there and get you guys that are gonna be program changing dudes and help you have a chance to win the league. And I think that helped me be able to move up pretty quick in the profession because I always had that niche, and I always was, you know, lucky enough to deliver, because some of it's luck. It's not an exact science. There's a lot of I'm certainly not batting 1,000. I wish that I was, but I've been able to get more that have really been good players than I've missed on. I think that's the key as an assistant or as a head coach.
Yeah. And it's one thing to like recruit some good players, get a talented roster. But you also have to like coach them and adjust to them. And when you're dealing with transfers, their timeline and their mindset is probably a little different than, you know, your typical freshman or even a junior college kid. How have you been so successful at coaching a team with so many transfers and, you know, JUCO, you know, a mix?
Yeah, I think it's my personality. I try to recruit kids that fit my personality. They're going to be successful here. I think it's number one. I think a lot of guys just take guys based on their talent level. This, I try to get guys that are going to be able to really be successful with what we do here. And I'm brutally honest with kids. I think that's the only way to be. Sometimes they don't like me for it, but they appreciate it in the long run. That's how I coach my guys. That's how I recruit them. I'm very honest in the recruitment process. So when they get here, there's not really any, I mean, I tell them, you know, I told you I was going to coach you hard. I told you we were going to work really hard. But you said you wanted that because you wanted to get to your dreams and goals. And I promised you that I would help you get there. And, you know, so I'm really honest with them. The other part is I have a great staff. Without a really good staff, it's hard for anything to work. I think that's the most underappreciated thing in college basketball or any organization, period, is how good the people are that you can put around you. And I've been really fortunate to make some good decisions of who I've put around our programs, you know, when at Nichols and at South Alabama. I've had unbelievable staffs. And I got guys that are ready to be head coaches. And I think it's important. I got guys that are bought into what we want to do and the culture of what we do and the things that are important. So yeah, my staff gets heck more credit to me, to be honest. I'm very lucky. And the other thing is we really try to evaluate that, and we try to evaluate these transfers. I watch before I take a kid, I watch every made basket, every missed basket, every rebound, every assist, every turnover, and multiple games on synergy before I take. So when I talk to them in recruiting, I know everything about their game, the good, the bad, what they need to get better at, how we can utilize those guys. And I think our work level to get these dudes, not only how many calls, we're putting in a million calls and text and FaceTime and just being creative with our approach. But our detailed approach to know their game is what separates us sometimes. And I tell them as soon as we start recruiting them, there's a million power five. There's a bunch of power fives talking to you. There's this, there's that. You can do all that. It's fine. I'm telling you right now, when you look at what we've done with transfers, the success rate, how we do things here, we're as good, if not better, than anybody in the country with what you're looking for. And I always say, don't go to a foot doctor for brain surgery. That foot doctor is really intelligent. He may have a nice building, may have all that. You know, that's great. It doesn't make him a bad doctor. Doesn't make his setup bad. But you're not looking for that. You know, these transfers are looking for a certain thing. And we do that here. And I think that's what's allowed us to get some guys that, quote unquote, people say that we shouldn't get.
Okay. I love that you gave me the recruiting pitch there. That's great stuff. But you can say that now because you're like 5-6 years in. But like your first head job is at Nichols State, which first of all, like a lot of people would have passed up on that opportunity because they don't have this great tradition of success. You I want to know like what the recruiting pitch was then, because that first year you got a bunch of really good transfers there at Nichols. And in year two, you guys win the league, which is unheard of. Like that doesn't happen at Nichols State. I don't know my Nichols State history. Maybe apologies if they had a golden era in the '80s or whatever. But you know what I mean? Like it was a quote unquote bad job. First of all, like what made you jump in and take it? And then like, how did you convince and get everybody on board with your vision early on there?
Yeah, it's a great story, actually. I'm glad you asked me about it, because Nichols State will always be special to me, man. And you're exactly right. They went to the NCAA tournament in 1998. They had one winning season in 20 years prior to me getting there. And I'll take you back, though. After my first year at Clemson, I went to the finals of the Northern Kentucky job. And everybody knew it was an unbelievable job. They had just made the transition from D2 to D1. Facilities, crazy, great location. Just a great opportunity. I went to the finals. It's funny. The finals were me, John Brannon, and Laval Jordan. And we were all there in one building interviewing at the same. It was one of the oddest deals. But that's how it went. And John got it, obviously, and they made a great decision. He was incredible. And he's at Cincinnati now, and he'll do great there too. But anyway, I was crushed because I really felt like I was going to get it. It was the first interview I'd ever interviewed for assistant, all the assistant interviews I'd gotten. And so that was my first taste of rejection. So I came back off that, and I went, and that spring I got to do the extended part of Villa 7, back when Villa 7 was going, and that was interviewing in front of ADs, and they film you and they pick you apart, and I look like a clown. Like my body language, how I presented myself was not good. and I saw it on film, and you know, it's like our players, that's the best teacher, is they see themselves on film. So anyway, after that, I told myself, I said, I'm going to be a head coach in a year. And Coach Brownell used to give me a hard time because he was like, you need to wait. You don't want to be a head coach too soon, because then you got to stay a head coach, you know, the rest of your life. Then you don't want to be an assistant. So he would tell me that. So anyway, we get to the spring, and I see, you know how coaches are, man. You're always on Twitter. You're addicted to Twitter. So I was on Twitter nonstop. Still am. My wife hates it, but I'm on there nonstop. So Nichols State, you know, as soon as somebody gets let go, it's all over Twitter. And I had no clue about Nichols State, where it was at. No, nothing. I just knew it was a Division I school. And anyway, I got on immediately, got on the internet, started looking who was there. And a guy named Andrew Kearney was their compliance guy. And I recruited him at Hawaii Pacific. I think he's actually older than me, but I recruited him when I was at Hawaii Pacific. And so I called somebody that I knew would have his number. I got his number. I called him and I said, hey, man, this is Richie Riley. I'm at Clemson. He was like, yeah, I know where you're at, man. Yeah, yeah. And we started talking about him recruiting me. I mean, me recruiting him. And I said, man, I would love to be the head coach at Nichols State. He was like, why? And so we talked about the job a little bit. He went to his boss, Rob Bernardi. So Rob, out of courtesy, called me and said, you know, we're going to hire a Louisiana guy. That's kind of how it has to go here. If not, you know, it's just hard to be able to do anything. And plus, you're a high major assistant. Our budget's so low, you know. And I told him, and I just rolled the dice. I said, if you want to keep doing what you're doing, then do that. If you want to change the program and go win, then give me a chance. And he thought about it. And next thing you know, he called me back and offered me an opportunity to come interview. So me and my wife drive down, and my son, Reese, we had another one on the way. Rock was on the way. So she was pregnant. We're going through swamps, man. It's like swamps on each side. If you veer left or veer right, like you might not come back from it. And she's like, what in the world? So we get to the town, and it's just one straight shot right into, there's nothing really. And anyway, I interview. They tell me the budget. We had a $1,000 recruiting budget, period, $1,000. Top four lowest budgets in the country, Division I. And at the end of it, we talk about it, and they say they're going to let me know. And we leave, and Jeff was like, well, I mean, that was fun. We're obviously not going to do it, but it was fun. So I get back, and they call. It's on a Friday, and they offer me the job. And I tell him, I got to talk to my wife. I talked to her for an hour. And I'm like, now we're not going to do it, you know. So I call and I say, I appreciate the opportunity. I'm not going to do it. So they call back, and a really good, one of my best friends in the world now, his name's Quinn Strander. He lives down there. He runs all, he's big time dude. I had met him when I was down there, and he told the AD, he said, tell him we'll give him $20,000 more. And I was taking it with the $20,000 I took, I think it was 80, 85, 90, something like that, $1,000 pay cut from Clemson. But when they did that, it changed my whole mindset. And I was sitting in a gym. It was April. I was sitting in a gym in Atlanta, Georgia, recruiting for Clemson. And when he called and told me that, and it changed my whole mindset, because $20,000 for them was like so much more money for some other school. So I called my wife and I looked around the gym. I looked at everybody in there, all the assistants, the head coaches. And I said, it's like win the lottery to become a Division I head coach. It's so hard. I understand this job is like, people say it's impossible. You know, I talked to Shaka, who's one of my mentors, and he told me, you know, you don't need to do that. You can get a better, all this stuff. And I walked out of the gym. I called my wife and I said, we're going to do it. And she almost cried. and I called him. I said, I'm coming. And I took the job that night and we went down there. And thankful I have such a special wife, because a lot of people might have divorced me, because we had another kid on the way and we were leaving a lot of money on the table. But I burned the boats, bet on myself, and went down there with a $1,000 recruiting budget, fundraised like crazy, and just worked really, really hard to give us a chance.
So it wasn't really about the money. It was that extra $20,000 just showed their commitment, which is what got you fired up about it. Uh-oh, I think we lost Coach Riley here for a minute. Coach Riley, can you hear me?
I got you now. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yep.
No, I was saying when it came to recruiting, I tried to keep the same confidence that I've always had. And my biggest sell with those kids is, you know, with Roddy Peters and Tavon Sadler, the two big-time transfers that we had, when we first got there, signed them that first summer, and they sat out a year and they ended up being all league guys and ultimately won the league. As I told them, I said, man, like, you know, you're coming down here to try to make your dreams and goals come true. They had both been around the block a little bit, been a couple different places. And I said, don't get caught up in the gym. If you're signing to come play at a nice gym, this ain't it. If you're signing to come play somewhere with a bunch of stuff in the town, this ain't it. But if you're coming somewhere where you're going to play for somebody that's going to do everything in his power to help you get to your dreams and goals, relentlessly push you so that you get better as a player and as a man, and come somewhere where you can actually change a program, then it's here. So don't get caught up in all that. So it was big that we sold our staff and we sold who we are more so than the resources that we had, because we didn't have any resources. We had to sell a vision of who we are and what our program was going to be about, not the bells and whistles of our programs. We didn't have that. I mean, it was rough. I'll tell you one thing, though, about Nicholls State. It's a special place. The people there are incredible. I loved every second that I was there. I still miss it, to be honest. I loved every second that I was there. Awesome people. And we were able to do something incredibly special that I'll never forget. I'll never forget that. I'll never forget them having the belief in me to give me a chance either.
Well, and what's awesome is to see Clonch keeping it rolling there, and they're still having success. And so you've built a program that's lasted longer than you have there, which is pretty special.
No, that was important to me. When I went to bat for Clonch to get the job, when I was on my way out to come up here, I knew that he could keep it going. Just special. He is I talk about Clonch like I talk about a player, like incredibly talented. Incredibly talented.
Clonch has picked up the Louisiana accent. He's been down there a little while. It's hard to understand him now. He sounds like the guy on the Water Boy sometimes.
Yes, he does. He's so gifted as a coach, and he works extremely hard. His future, man, there's no cap on that, how great he's going to be in this profession. And he's keeping it going, man. And got a chance to take it to new heights. You know, he's got a chance. I think he'll be right there in the conference tournament this year to have a chance to win the whole thing.
Absolutely. Hey, real quick, going to talk about Fulcrum Technologies for a second. You mentioned all the schools you've been at, everywhere you've been. You always got a video editing system. whatever it may be, and they're different wherever you're at, and you got to learn different ones. Fulcrum Tech is as good as anything, if not better, and it's like a fraction of the price. Not that I want to like harp on the value of it and the cost value, but because their product really does stand next to anything out there. But especially now with COVID, budgets lean, people having to make cuts, it would be silly not to call up Fulcrum Tech in the off season, or call them up now, set up a demo, and at least check it out. You can get just as much video editing, if not better, than what your program has for a fraction of the cost. Check them out, Fulcrum Tech. Coach Riley, appreciate you being part of that live commercial for me.
I'm all about it. I don't know anything about some of that technology stuff, but it sounded, you sold me on it. It sounded pretty good. I may have my crew call and ask them, see what they got to offer.
Yeah, there we go. Okay. All right. I kind of want to go back to this and dig in just a little bit deeper on coaching a team full of transfers. When you got all new people, you don't have, of course you have some carryover from year to year. But you got that year to develop guys if they got to sit out. If you got grad transfers that are coming in new, what are you spending more time than most on team chemistry? How are you building that rapport? And not just off the court, people spend a lot of, I feel like people talk a lot about building the culture off the court, but you got to get dudes comfortable playing with each other on the court too, right? How are you bringing that to life?
No, you do. I think the first step, what I really focus on, our staff focuses on, is putting the pieces together the right way. You can have a lot of really good pieces, but if you don't put it together the right way, it's kind of like an NBA roster. If you don't put it together the right way where guys can play well together, certain skill sets mesh together, then it's really hard. I mean, you can't have five ball dominant guys out there trying to play. You can't win like that. And you can't have, you know, five guys that are really talented, but they don't defend, you know, or anything. We try to piece it together the right way and add not only skill sets and strengths mixed together, but also mentality, like who they are as a person. We try to get to know guys, and so that we piece the right personalities together. And then when they get here, we spend an unbelievable amount of time with them on the court and off the court. We pride ourselves in working harder than anybody in the country with skill development on the court. We pride ourselves in being the most conditioned team. I think it's paid off this year because we're playing with six guys. And we push our kids really hard. And sometimes when you coach them hard and you spend a lot of time with them, you just develop a bond that is like unbreakable. And that's what we try to do. We try to have that relationship with our kids that's an unbreakable bond. So that, because you're going to have adversity. You're going to have, I don't care how well you think you piece it together, you're going to have some adversity. And you can't attack that adversity if you don't have those relationships built in. So I think that's really important. We try to do so. COVID year has been hard, but we try to do so much stuff off the court, team building things. We spend a lot of time with our guys. And again, my staff is incredible at that. As a head coach, I try to be the best that there is, spending time with their guys and having that relationship with them. But my staff is on another level when it comes to that. Our kids have a high level of respect for them, and they know that they have their best interest at heart. And I think that's the biggest thing with transfers with anybody, but especially transfers, because a lot of times transfers have struggled with, they signed somewhere, it didn't go the way they thought it would. There's already been some trust issues of, you know, in recruiting, I was told that, you know, so you're getting these guys and they already have that ingrained a little bit. So they have to be able to trust you, and they have to be able to know that you genuinely care about them. And we do that. And my staff relays my message at an elite level. They really, really do a good job of that. And they're there to pick up the pieces, because I'm really competitive and I coach with a lot of passion. I'm brutally honest all the time. And some days in practice or in the heat of a game, our guys might get a little bit frustrated with me or might, you know, get mad or down. And my staff does a really good job of being able to relay my message to them and keep everybody together. And that's been a staple of our teams. We've had a lot of transfers, really impact ones. But at the staple of our teams are they're really together and they genuinely care about each other.
What's been your biggest growth as a head coach?
I don't know. I got a long ways to go. I got a lot of areas I need to improve in. I would think my biggest area of growth is probably my patience, and my staff would probably laugh. I don't know if I'm wrong here, but they would probably laugh because I'm not the most patient, but I am way more patient than I was 4 or 5 years ago when I became a head coach. And that's with everything. Used to, the smallest thing would just, I would lose my complete mind. I remember being at Nichols, you know, one of my GAs has been with me for all 5 years since I've been a head coach. He was a player for me 2 years at Nichols, and he's been here, you know, we're in year three right now here. He's been here. And he talks about how much more patient I am with these guys than I was with him. I would lose my mind over anything. You know, somebody would have their jersey untucked, walking out on the court and pray, I would just completely lose it. Now I just, you know, hey, tuck your jersey in, man, you know. Or a guy would have an earring in, he forgot to take his earring out. I'll just lose it. I would make him run or something. You know, just set a fire that didn't need to be set. And now just be like, hey, man, you think you're going to the club or what? Man, this is practice. Get your earring out. And kind of laugh it off. So a lot of those areas I've grown to be more patient and understanding and know that you don't have to come in, you know, swinging on every battle. You know, you can get your message across sometimes without completely losing your mind. So patience. But again, I got a long way to go in a lot of areas, patience included. But you know, I'm working on that daily. I tell our guys all the time, I'm still working on being the best coach I can be. I tell them to spend countless hours working on getting better and just be obsessed with that process. And I'm the same. I'm obsessed with getting better from a strategical standpoint, recruiting standpoint, and just overall running a basketball program standpoint.
Okay. Last thing I want to talk about here is you mentioned that you're a forward thinking guy. You know, you were ahead of the curve on transfers. What's next? Obviously you got some things coming down the pike with NLI in the next year or so. You got, I'm sure in the next couple of years, kids will be able to transfer without sitting out. What's kind of like the next wave or area where you can carve out an advantage in recruiting or building a roster?
That transfer rule, it better come through this spring. I'm going to have that. It better not be 2 years away. I need that. It is supposed to go through this spring. And I think the name, image, and likeness is going to be a wild card when it comes out, especially at the Power Five level. I think there's so many things that go into it. It's hard for me to wrap my mind around that yet. I'm trying to understand. It's hard for me to wrap my mind around it. But I think as the game goes, man, these kids are changing so much. It's different than when I first started coaching. Their demeanors, what they know, what they don't know. I mean, these kids now, man, they know so many things going on in the world right now that when I was their age, I had no clue, man. Sure. I was doing just to get out of bed and make my way to class and figure out how to get back home before dark. I mean, it's like these kids know everything. And I think in recruiting, we got to continue to evolve with how creative we are. The transfer market, I think, is something without guys sitting out is obviously going to be a trend. I think you'll see everybody from the Blue Bloods. I think the Blue Bloods will be in the market more than they ever have been. So I think we got to do that. But we also, you know, you got to do a good job of not forgetting that there's players everywhere. I talk to my staff about that all the time. You know, a lot of times, you know, you get your best players when all the action's going this way. It's like a misdirection play, man. Everything starts going this way in the transfer market. You slide in and you get you a guy you shouldn't get at the high school level. So I think we've got to do a good job of being informed and continuing to be forward thinking and watching how everything with the ebbs and flows, man, because it's a never ending movement. And I, you know, luckily we've always been kind of ahead of it where we need to be. And I think we will. Again, I have an incredible staff. So we're obviously very, very dialed into the transfer market, very dialed into the JUCO scene. And very dialed into the high school kids too. So, but the long answer anyway to what you're saying that I didn't say is I think internationally things are going to pick up. I think people are starting to really try to dive in internationally more than they were years ago. You had guys that were dialed into it. Gonzaga is obviously the king of it. But you got other places that have done really well with it. So I think you'll see more of a spread into international recruiting as well as the other ones.
Did that Nichols State $1,000 recruiting budget allow you guys to send people overseas to to see firsthand?
No, I'll tell you a funny story. I was recruiting a kid out at Cochise in Arizona, a JUCO. And so I called a coach. I called Jerry. Great dude, man. Jerry Carrillo, I called him. And I was sitting there talking about this kid's game, you know, like crazy when I was at Nichols. I was like, I love him. He does this. He does that. You know, he did this, this game, that game. And he stopped me finally. I talked for about 10 minutes straight. Probably stopped me. He said, Coach, when were you out here? And I said, I've never been out there, Coach, in my life. He said, well, how'd you know all that? I said, man, I said, I've watched every single thing on this kid on Synergy. I said, I've got a $1,000 recruiting budget. I can't afford to come out there. So I've got to recruit off this Synergy. And then I've got to do a good job on the phone convincing you that this is the right place for him. And then convincing him. And he loved it. He loved it. He loved that I'd put in that time. And he also loved that we were just scrapping, trying to find a way to be good without money to do it. So, no, we certainly couldn't go overseas. I couldn't even make it out to wherever that is in Arizona. So I wasn't making any trips over to Europe.
Well, good thing the film doesn't lie. So you can do everything right there from your laptop. You're right. Well, Coach, I appreciate you taking the time. Six in a row. Good luck keeping it rolling here. I think you got two or three left in the regular season. So we wish you the best of luck.
I wish it was two or three. I wish it would go down. We got four. Got four. No room for error. So we got to keep getting better this week, and we're going to have to play our best this weekend to have a chance to win.
Well, best of luck. We'll be following along and rooting for you guys. And again, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks. I enjoyed it. You guys keep doing great things, man. Ton of respect for you.
Thanks.
What's up, podcast fans? I want to share some information about one of our partners, Lucio Sports. The team at Lucio has built an integrated platform of coaching productivity and player development apps that are being used by some of the best basketball programs around the globe, helping everyone from NBA champions to youth development academies. Their innovative and competitive memorization games make it so much easier for new players and staff members to remotely get caught up to speed. With animated playbooks, drill libraries, player development planning and monitoring, engaging game plans and scouting reports, predictive play drawing, their content services team, and more, Lucio Sports has got you covered. From players to coaches to support staff and executives, use Lucio Sports to securely keep everyone in your organization on the same page with simple on-demand access to your team's entire knowledge base. For more information, check out luciosports.com. That's LUCEO sports.com.